happy Easter afternoon. How's that?
That was good.
Kind of dates our show, but too bad. It's Easter. That's kind of awesome.
We're all over it.
And we were going to take the day off, but then we made a last minute. It was kind of like you were going to miss your exit because you were driving on the freeway and you get like that. And then you go, oh my gosh, it's my exit. That's what I did last night.
Yeah. And it worked out.
I reached out to our friend William Kay and, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? Hey, what are you doing tomorrow? And then we took the exit.
Yeah.
And here we are. So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we have our friend from Canada, William Kay.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hiding in the telephone there. How's it going?
Very well.
Well, Bill's had these trade shows and not complaining because he's, you know, back to work and all that.
Gainfully employed.
Yeah. That sounds so. I just got out of jail. Well, maybe that's just how
right,
so.
No, let's clear that up right now. That is not the case.
I'm gainfully employed.
He got an amnesty by Obama.
He got his driver's license back and everything.
I know it. I'm somebody.
You got to say it right, though. I'm somebody.
That's right.
So, I don't know, just thought it was kind of a bad deal to do to folks, although it's Easter Sunday, so they're probably not listening anyway.
Oh, they are listening.
Oh.
They were hoping we'd be here.
Really?
Absolutely.
They're rubbing their little hands together?
Kids are all out gathering their little Easter eggs,
and the parents are like,
We the People Radio.
What are these guys going to talk about
today?
I hope
you hit them good. It'd take them a long time to find them.
So we're just kind of winging it. Yeah. We're winging it with William Kay.
So Bill is one of the reasons the employment picture is looking better.
There you go.
That's right. I added to the numbers.
Uh-huh.
The dismal numbers.
I don't know. It's pretty hard because we don't calculate the numbers of actually people who are unemployed. We only count people who are on unemployment, right?
No,
isn't that the deal?
Yeah.
The people
who
stopped getting...
But they don't count the people who quit being
that's
on
what
unemployment
I mean.
And still are unemployed.
Right.
Yeah.
So we don't actually count the real unemployed
and we don't
people.
Count the people who are underemployed, those working part-time who wish to work full-time.
Oh,
yeah.
You're right.
The 20-hour-a-week people.
Yeah, like the lovely young man who helped me at AutoZone down in Chico last week. Mm-hmm. I had to get a... steering wheel cover because, I don't know, I'm having this thumb problem anyway. And there was no way I was stretching this stupid steering wheel cover over my steering wheel because you had to be a big-time wrestler in order to do it. And
big-time AutoZone.
And the kid's like, oh, yeah, hey, I'll help you out with that. So he comes out and does all that. Nicest guy. And I guess he works there full-time and he works at Home Depot part-time. And
oh, so he's hogging somebody else's
job. Yeah, but he
had... Well, no wonder the employment numbers are wrong.
Exactly. He had multiple jobs, and I thought...
He's skewing him the wrong way.
Yeah.
Oh, what a nice guy. I hope he finds a real job that pays him well. So anyway, I didn't catch his name. I was going to send his manager a nice note, and I was like, oh, great. I look at my receipt later. He's cashier number 12. I'd like to compliment number 12.
Shout out to cashier number 12.
Cash out to number 12. I was like, dang it. I could have looked at his name
Thanks
tag.
Thanks for that shout out, Bob. I'm sure he appreciates it.
So I would have liked to have given the kid a, I don't know, I'll figure out who he is.
Shout out to Canada. Eh?
Yeah. Can you tell me who's number 12? So, William, what do you guys have up there? Do you guys have this big unemployment deal, too, or did you guys give up on that a long time ago and just
Typically,
lie about it?
It's a little higher in Canada than the United States.
Really?
We have the same sort of statistical problem. They don't count people who are not gainfully looking for employment. What they do is a telephone survey, which is going to miss a lot of people. And you have to say that you've been looking for work in the last period of time. But a lot of these centers have such high unemployment, there's really no point for the people to be looking.
Well, no, because you...
Count. They don't count Indians on reserves. They don't count people in prison. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which they... skewer the numbers. It's always better to look at just the actual number of people who are employed.
Even that's
a guesstimate.
Do you guys have unemployment? Like when people lose their job, do you have a certain period of time? Like do you pay into unemployment and then they kind of...
Well, we used to call it unemployment insurance. They changed the name to employment insurance. That made everybody a lot happier.
Oh, sure.
And there's all sorts of these typical social programs. There's welfare, old age supplement.
Yeah, but you guys
it's more of a welfare state in Canada than the United States.
But you guys in Canada, when you're unemployed, you can go out and cut wood and mine and do all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah,
we can't do that down
here. Trap beaver.
Okay, that's where I was going. Canoe out in the wilderness, and shoot bows and arrows and wear pelts.
William's up there with his fuzzy raccoon hat on.
Yeah, totally different.
Stagecoach.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, You were saying, and I mean, we didn't really talk so much about what we were going to do, but you were talking about Syria, and you said you were gonna cram. So for the last few hours that we've been walking the dog, goofing off, and that sort of thing, because we went to church last night, we got a kind of a little jump on it there. But you had said that you want to talk about Syria.
Well, that's what was on my mind.
Fire away.
I think what happened earlier this month was such a stark reversal within the Trump administration, and such a 180-degree turn. People talk about regime change in Syria. You just had regime change in the United States. That was such a change, and it happened so quickly. It appears to me, it all ties into the environmental stuff, but there's a real danger now that if Trump is capable of such a stark change of opinion in foreign policy, it seems to be that he might be capable of doing that regarding any policy. This is a person who someone bothered to count on 45 times, said that he would not, you know, get engaged in Syria. He criticized Hillary Clinton rightly for advocating no-fly zones and what have you in Syria that would probably provoke World War III. And then after that chemical attack, you know, according to my timeline, I went this. The New York Times got this sort of. It was 63 hours between the chemical attack and the American response, the cruise missile attack. But it was less than 36 hours from the chemical attack to the decision to bomb Syria, and it just you know it beggars the imagination how that could possibly have happened. And the likelihood of, I agree with Ron Paul, the likelihood of the Assad regime causing that chemical attack is zero. That simply did not happen. That was so obviously a staged event by Al-Qaeda. I would go one step further. The likelihood of Trump and Tillerson and those people believing that Assad was responsible is zero. They could not possibly believe that they actually did that.
How come the Russians haven't come out and said that Assad wasn't responsible? They've been kind of quiet.
They have? It hasn't been reported in the Western media. Breitbart reported it. If you go to RT, the Russian television station, Putin, in as many words, said this is a false flag operation. This was a fake operation done by Al-Qaeda, in as many words. His spokesperson said the term false flag, and that was a direct quote from Putin.
And so what's the benefit of the United States by creating a false flag?
Well, the Americans didn't do it. The Al-Qaeda did it.
Okay.
The town where this happened, Khan Shikun is the name of the town, has been in the control of Al-Qaeda for at least 4 years now, like fully in the control. So for the first 2 or 3 days after this attack, the entire crime scene, if you will, was still completely in control of Al-Qaeda. There wasn't a Western journalist in there for a couple of days. So all of the information that we were getting from about this chemical attack was coming through. Well, it's called, you know, it goes through many names. Al-Qaeda has changed its name 3 or 4 times in Syria. They're fooling nobody. But, you know, you had BBC, Reuters, all these different news agencies reporting this chemical attack, assuring us that it was nerve gas, assuring us that it was from an aircraft had delivered it. 100% of that information was coming from Al-Qaeda. There wasn't a single Western correspondent in that town for the first few days. The Trump administration made the decision to respond by force before a single Western journalist had entered that town.
And so how did Al-Qaeda get the chemical weapons? Did they steal them from Assad?
Couple of theories. There's one theory that it wasn't nerve gas.
A lot
of the reports was that it had a powerful smell, like a powerful odor to it.
Like chlorine.
Chlorine or one of the other sort of cheapo chemical weapons, because nerve gas has no smell. Also, the initial photographs of the Al-Qaeda types inspecting the crater in the ground, nobody's wearing hazmat uniforms.
Right.
You'd be dead as a doorknob if there was sarin gas around there. There was a variety of other things like that that led people to believe that maybe it wasn't. nerve gas. It could have been some cheapo stuff. However, it's likely that Turkey might have stashes of nerve gas. They might have given them to the Syrian opposition. I think they go by the name of Tarin al-Sham now. But before that, they were the al-Nusra Front that controls this town. And that group was the official franchise operation of al-Qaeda in Syria and had been since 2011. But they've gone through a series of rebrandings and name changes. There's always an effort to make them appear to be a moderate force, when in fact they're the same sort of extremist Islamist, jihadist, terrorist groups as the rest of them. But without a doubt, and all the New York Times reported that ISIS and al-Qaeda and this whole sort of milieu of movement in there, they've used chemical weapons over 60 times. So it's not beyond them to do it. And you have to just sit back for a second and say, what would motivate Assad and the Russians to use a chemical attack like that? I mean, the town had no strategic military value.
Other than it was occupied by his enemies.
Sure.
The actual residential area that got hit didn't have any military value. It was in their territory. Now, I'm glad that you're taking an oppositional view to this. But you think one commentator was describing, if they really wanted to, kill those civilians in that neighborhood, why wouldn't they just drop a barrel bomb on them? Have they done that? I mean, Assad has done that before.
Well, he did it after the strike, too, didn't he?
There was an attack on a medical clinic hours after the strike. Once again, there still were no Western journalists around. This is entirely the narrative of al-Qaeda. But the argument was that first there was this chemical attack. We can get into the details. It's very, very dubious. Then hours later, there was an attack on the medical facility where a lot of the patients were being taken. And this was done presumably to cover up the evidence, although it certainly didn't, and it's hard to see how it could have. But there definitely was an airstrike on that town. Initially, the Russians and Syrians thought they might have hit a chemical storage dump controlled by al-Qaeda. That was their initial speculation. But as sort of, a few days went by, it's becoming increasingly obvious that, no, that was actually a chemical release done, deliberately by al-Qaeda.
Not from the air.
What they've got is a crater on the street, about 4 feet wide, 1 foot deep. And it is, it was at the time downwind or sort of upwind from where the village, not the village, but sort of the neighborhood that got gas was. So whoever released that canister of gas, if it was indeed released from that crater where al-Qaeda said it was released from, had to have known what direction the wind was blowing. So what they keep showing us is this photograph of this little crater in the middle of the road with this cylinder in it. There's an MIT professor called Theodore Postol. He's investigated these things before, and he keeps looking at this photograph, and he says a number of things about it. One, if you look at the cylinder, it's split from stem to stern. And he said, that's the sort of destruction you would get if the cylinder had been laid on the ground on its side and an explosion had occurred above it. It wouldn't break apart that way if it was just fired directly into the ground. Mm. Also, whoever fired that cylinder, if it was fired from an aircraft, had to know what direction the breeze was blowing on the ground, and a pilot way up in the air wouldn't know that. And there's only this single canister. Typically, when an aircraft is going to deliver chemical munitions, they drop a large canister, which is full of small metal balls. The metal balls contain the poison, the chemicals. And inside each little metal ball, there's another chamber with a very small explosion. So you drop a large canister, it breaks apart in the air. And then you've got, 100 little baseballs falling towards the earth. On impact, each little baseball bursts open. The amount of explosive is not even a teaspoon. It's just enough to burst the ball open. But because you've got hundreds of little balls, you get dispersal of the chemical agent. If you're just, no one's ever heard of like firing a rocket straight into the dirt as a means of dispersing a chemical agent. Had that rocket, according to theory, hit soft ground, gone through the roof of a building, hit a, you know, a pond or a swamp, it wouldn't have dispersed the agent at all.
Right.
So that MIT prof says, you know, no way does anyone, you know, fire chemical weapons like shooting a rocket straight into the ground from extremely high altitude, that you cause a crater in an asphalt road. No, that's not how anybody disperses agents. You know, the likelihood of you, you know, just sinking it into a wet ditch somewhere and killing no one is too high. And allegedly, all of the fatalities result from this one rocket, which, you know, in retrospect is absurd.
Well, you know, being the devil's advocate
devil's advocate. We have to take a commercial break before you devil your advocate, okay?
All right.
And you're going to devil me some eggs later. Okay, just
FYI. That's a good idea.
Okay. But I digress. We need to take a really quick break. We're chatting this morning with William Kay. William, are you out of Alberta?
Yeah.
Okay, because Canada's a big place. And I was...
So is Alberta.
I'm thinking, I think I know what town he's in. Okay, he's in Alberta. We'll be right
Alberta's
back.
Alberta's not a town.
Well, no, but at least it's a place. It's not a giant country.
It is. State of mind.
We'll be right back. When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? You never steal. Of course we have a song about that.
Monkey Ball.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us online to send us hate mail after today, probably for goofing off on Easter, at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with our friend William Kay from Alberta, Canada. And Alberta's a province. That's the word I couldn't find. I could think of county.
Yes.
I could think of state.
We don't have
states
of the Union. We have provinces of the Dominion.
Oh, I could think
of... Alberta has a capital city, which is called Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that is where I am.
Nice. Well, I just was trying to give a better locator than Canada. It's a big place. I forgot about the whole province thing. Even down here, we don't have any uniformity. Like, we have county supervisors, but the guys up north of us in Oregon have county commissioners. So, I don't know. I think everybody's making up their own stuff. So, Devil's Advocate is still sitting here in the studio.
Yes,
Look at Louisiana has parishes instead of counties.
Oh, yeah, see, there
That's
you
right.
go.
Well, just so you know,
we're just doing it
I looked this up. The country of Syria has almost the same land area and population as the state of Florida.
Oh.
Hmm.
Just so you can sort of visualize the whole affair.
Yeah.
Hmm. Kind of bigger
same
than
same population, same land mass.
Formidable
in Florida.
Yeah.
And well, probably around the same sort of heat, too. It's hot there. So.
Yeah.
Well,
so
my devil's advocate position here was, granted, this may not have been a high-tech device dropped from the air and for mass distribution. But Assad is known for, you know, dropping barrel bombs. Why couldn't they have put some canister full of some homemade stuff in a barrel and dropped it in the middle of the street? Would have had the same effect, wouldn't it?
Well, wouldn't dynamite have the same effect?
Well, but I'm saying as far as the chemical agent, you said that it was one canister that was split open. That could have come out of a barrel bomb, couldn't it?
The aircraft that was above it, which the Americans were tracking because the Russians told them it was going to be there, it's an Su-22. It's a fighter bomber. Barrel bombs usually dropped out of helicopters. And it would have to be precise. Like, once again, had this thing gone through the roof of a house or into some pond, nobody would have got killed. But if Assad simply wanted to kill the people in that neighborhood. Had he used dynamite and a barrel bomb, it wouldn't have made any headlines. I mean, that sort of thing happens all the time. He's dropped 1,000 barrel bombs. I don't, view him as a particularly evil guy, but he has been rather ruthless in his prosecution of the civil war, and there's been a lot of collateral damage.
Right.
And, you know, over the years, you know, if Al-Qaeda or the oppositional forces are, you know, fighting out of a civilian area, he has not wavered in terms of sending in, you know, free fall bombs and barrel bombs into those neighborhoods. And there has been a lot of civilian damage, a lot of collateral damage to this. So if he really just wanted to blast them, he would have used that, and it wouldn't have made the news.
So you don't think
Look at the city of Aleppo. It's 2.5 million people. Take some photographs of that. The place has been demolished.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he didn't use any chemical weapons.
Well, why use
chemical weapons here?
Well, you don't think maybe he was kind of testing the waters to see if Trump was going to be the same as Obama and kind of back off and have the same position? You know, let's test this out and see what happens.
That's one theoretical motivation. I strongly question the previous chemical attack that was blamed upon him.
Mm-hmm.
One person who questioned that strongly was the head of the CIA. There's some good articles online as to why Obama ultimately backed down. It was because he was getting some high-level intelligence saying that they had serious reservations as to whether or not Assad was responsible for that chemical attack either. And there's some very good reason to believe that he was not responsible for that. But at the moment of this attack, it was on the eve of a huge conference in Europe about the future of Syria. Syrians and the Russians had been reaching out to the West, to the politicians, to public opinion. They were trying to make nice and give the best possible spin on their own regime. They are, in fact, winning the war on the ground, slowly and brutally, but they are, you know, they've driven them out of Aleppo. They've driven them up into that Idlib province, which is primarily a rural area. So there was, you know, they weren't as though they were in some desperate situation where they had to resort to these sorts of things. And they did it at a time when they were really reaching out to the Trump administration in particular. So using chemical weapons would thwart that whole agenda.
Right.
And that
totally makes sense. I don't argue with that. And I know that the Americans don't have a presence there because of our past policy. The Russians are getting a foothold over there, and it would be nice if something would happen that would get us back into the area, you know, according to the administration. So we could basically run the Russians out. This is a great idea to make everybody have egg on their face, and we come in and be the good guys. Well, I see that. I mean, that
Americans are on the ground in Syria in the very eastern part of the country, near the city of Raqqa.
Mm-hmm.
They have been, Hillary Clinton and Obama have been bankrolling large sections of the Syrian opposition since 2011. They have been there indirectly.
Right.
The people who really want to benefit from this, who are going to benefit from this, are, you know, our old friends in Saudi Arabia, you know, the Gulf Sheikhs, the oil monarchs. They have been determined to bring down that regime for several years now,
sure,
actually dating far back than that. Trump ran on a campaign that he wasn't going to support regime change in Syria, that he was going to ally with Assad and the Russians, make the primary enemy, ISIS, the Islamic fundamentalists, work with those groups to get rid of the Islamic fundamentalists. And then sort of, you know, he ran on an isolationist campaign.
Yeah,
that he
really
wasn't
did.
Going to come entangled in all these sort of foreign
right.
countries' problems.
Well, by staying out of that,
by
staying out of there, I think, aren't we allowing the Russians and Iran and Syria to kind of monopolize things over there? I mean, if we have any chance of having any kind of influence over there, which I don't know if we should or shouldn't. We should do something to influence a regime change. Because
really?
Assad is not our our friend. He's not a good guy.
Yeah, but who's going to take over behind him? That's
well,
the big thing.
Exactly.
You can't
exactly.
just you kick can't one trust guy out and leave it all.
Bottom line is there's so many players over there. You don't know who is who. And, I mean, every time there's been a regime change over there, it's turned out worse.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, these cities that were modern cities had a regime change. And they're rubble today.
And now they're Stone Age. Well, it's kind of interesting. I don't know if how much you follow the most of our media here is left media. But I was listening to Progressive Radio the other night, for, I don't know, I had a long drive. And so
for over an
hour, I listened to these people craft this amazingly complex web that Trump actually sent people over there who, you know, whether it was chemical or chlorine or, you know, sarin or whatever the gas was, that we did that so that Trump could go bomb Syria so that he could show everybody that he wasn't friends with the Russians because he bombed their ally.
Yeah.
It's like,
That conspiracy theory has been out there. That was coming from some of the mainstream media networks.
Yeah.
I haven't heard the part that actually linked the Trump administration to the initial chemical attack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did it
but
on purpose.
There were a lot of mainstream journalists who thought that he came down so hard on this just to prove that he wasn't a Putin agent, you know, to somehow
right.
undermine this whole campaign to discredit him as an agent of Russia. He did that. Of course, part of that conspiracy theory is that due to the deconfliction agreements with Russia, the Americans had to notify the Russians they were about to attack that air base that they attacked. So the Russians did have time to get out of there and no doubt told their Syrian allies the same. But about 90 minutes before the actual attack on the Syrian air base by the cruise missiles, the American military telephoned the Russians, told them exactly where they were going to attack, and gave them time to go out there. So that really feeds that conspiracy theory. That,
it does.
It really didn't do the Russians any harm. They got out of there. Nobody got hurt. It's sort of all for show. I don't buy it. It doesn't look like the Russians are buying it either. No, that was a complete game changer.
So where do you see it going? I mean, with recent events, where do you see Russia and Iran? I mean, Iran's been very quiet. North Korea's been very quiet. I think he got somebody's attention, don't you?
Oh, he's got the entire world's attention now.
Oh, yeah.
That was, a very reckless move. He has, you know, the agenda with Hillary and the rest of these people was for regime change in Syria, possible, you know, shooting war with Iran, really downgrading relations with Russia back to a Cold War status. That was where the train was going before Trump got elected.
Right.
And it seems to me that Trump initially tried to turn that thing around. The deep state, he tried to steer it in another direction. But it looks like Trump got turned around, and now the deep state is back on the initial trajectory that it was on, which is regime change in Syria, possible shooting war in North Korea. That's his own little spin. But once again, like really hostile relations with Russia. Putin said, I mean, relations have not been this bad, you know, since the Cold War. And the Russians were so optimistic when Trump got elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so was I. I mean, I realized this is a real breakthrough. It's a breakthrough for peace because he ran on this campaign of non-intervention. He ran on a campaign of getting along with Russia.
And, you know, it's sad that I agree 100% with that. But then the media turns around and spins it. We're in bed with Russia now. And, you know, he had all these previous deals set up and all. And now we've done a 180. And I don't know. I think we could have done some really good things had we had a little better relation with Russia. Now I don't see that
but
happening.
But does it or did it send a message that we're not just going to sit around and be afraid of our own shadow?
Oh, I think it did.
And maybe.
Because he is
maybe
now.
Maybe that accomplishes something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we've been such.
I think the world is looking at him now
curious.
Like a kind of a hot shot and don't mess around.
We have to take a quick break again, but when we come back,
okay.
I'd be kind of curious, William, what you. Because we don't really talk about foreign policy with you. We typically talk about, you know, the environmental stuff. But I'm kind of curious what you thought of the previous administration's footprint in foreign policy. Because, I don't know, here it was pretty frustrating. But when we come back, I'll be curious about that. Because I feel like I almost came in halfway through the movie. I don't know where you were before this started. So if we could hit that briefly when we return. You are listening to We the People. Bill didn't thank our sponsor, but he'll do that when we come back. You have 2 minutes to figure that out, Bill.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Get ready.
I'll put it up there.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Hey, we need to thank our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar, for sponsoring this first hour. And
good thing we got to it before the hour was over.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, but the first thing Monday morning, you need to call them and maybe talk to them about getting that pool heated up early. You can put a little solar pack on that thing, heat that pool up, be swimming in the next couple of weeks.
It'd
be pretty
exactly.
sweet. Yeah, Powerhouse Solar can do that for you. Call Bruce or Sue and talk to them about it. Their phone number is 530-275-5600, or you can get them online at powerhousesolar.com. They're out there on Caterpillar Road, and they'll do a really good job for you. Powerhouse Solar.
There you have it.
There you are.
Nice job, Bill.
Hey, thanks.
Okay. so what were we talking? Oh, yeah. Hey, William, what did you think of the Obama administration's foreign policy that was always kind of like, oh, if you do that again, we're going to do nothing? I mean, they had all these fake red lines.
They destroyed Libya.
Yes, they did.
Before I get into that, you're talking to a Canadian. I'm not actually an American.
I know. That's what's fun about it.
So I've got to explain something.
Oh, okay.
After World War II, the British, Canadian, and Australian and American governments signed a whole series of treaties, over 100 of them, that closely integrated the militaries of these countries. It wasn't just NATO, NORAD. There was a whole bunch of other deals and treaties dealing with, you know, weapon standardization and a common foreign policy. But there wasn't a lot of public discussion about these. Anyways, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy got on the telephone and he called the Canadian Prime Minister, who was a man by the name of John Diefenbaker. And he told Prime Minister Diefenbaker, I want you to put your military on the highest level of alert. It looks like this might actually turn into a war. And Diefenbaker said, well, you know, this is Canada. We really don't have this whole commander-in-chief phenomenon. I'm going to have to talk to Parliament. And Kennedy just told him, just do it. Do what I said. Diefenbaker hangs up the phone. He calls his defense minister. And he explains what just happened. And the defense minister says, well, just do it. Do what he said. And then Diefenbaker says, well, I'm not going to do this on my own. I'm at least going to have a cabinet meeting. So he summons all the cabinet members, not the whole parliament, just the cabinet, to discuss whether or not they're going to follow these instructions. When the defense minister hears that Diefenbaker is doing this, he's frustrated, so he calls the head of the Canadian Armed Forces, and he tells him behind Diefenbaker's back, put yourself on high alert. The head of the Canadian Armed Forces said, we already are. They got their orders directly from the Pentagon.
Oh, wow.
And all this political BS was window dressing. Mm-hmm. We are deeply integrated into the American military system here. There is a deep state in Canada as well. We've broken the rule, like under the Kretschmann administration, we did not participate in the Iraq war, although you notice the Australians and the British, these other countries, they always send token forces along with it. We did participate in a lot of the other foreign adventures of the American government. So we are pretty much locked into this system.
But wasn't that part of
his credit?
Wasn't that part of the NATO agreement?
There's NATO. There's a whole series called the Anglo-American Treaties. There's another one called NORAD, the North American Air Defense Agreements. There's a whole series of sort of military alliances and treaties that really tightly integrate. Like not all NATO countries went to Iraq for sure.
Right.
I think Spain did. countries can opt out of these things. Whereas there are certain sort of treaties where Canada cannot opt out of them. And the whole Cuban Missile Crisis sort of, told Canadians that there are certain things that happen in the Pentagon which are almost completely out of any electoral control. So we're sort of stuck into this system, although there are exceptions to the rule. I noticed that with this recent chemical attack, Canada's prime minister, which is, stuck his head out of the parapet and said that he's not convinced who's responsible for this chemical strike in Syria, which is rather unusual, but it's interesting to get that on the record. As for my general opinion about the whole Obama administration, no, I thought he was a pretty aggressive foreign policy guy. This whole covert war in Syria, him and Hillary and the whole gang, they're responsible for this. That war would not be going on. I don't know if you read Jane's Defense Weekly and some of these military publications. Someone leaked a shipping manifest to Jane's Defense Weekly regarding ammunition being shipped to the Syrian opposition. This is during the Obama administration, and this is one shipment, and it contained 98 cargo containers of ammunition. Those containers they put on the ships?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
98 of those full of ammunition. That was one shipment going from the American government to the Syrian opposition. That was 3 or 4 years ago. They have been channeling huge amounts of money and weapons into that opposition. They have been there, and it isn't as though he was some sort of pacifist. Hillary and Obama have got blood on their hands all the way up to their elbows. My main sort of hobby horse regarding sort of the foreign policy stuff is we really need to think about who our enemies and our allies are. I'm someone who has a very negative view or dim view of the oil monarchies, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi and these sorts of countries. I think those are very regressive places. They are serious sponsors of state terrorism. They are sort of Islamic imperialists. They have a profound and unwarranted influence in the policies of our governments and our culture as well.
And they also have a total unwillingness to participate in their own defense, which really, I don't understand why we put up with that.
Well, if we got schmoes that are going to do it for free, I guess why bother?
Exactly. that's exactly right. I mean, they have the most to lose by letting this all get out of control, and yet they sit back and, I mean, they don't even throw a lot of money at it. They just let the Americans get in there and get their hands dirty, or the British or whoever else wants to come in. NATO, they kind of sit back and go, I don't know, but these folks have the most to lose and participate the least, I think, in their own area. And I mean, how do you fix that?
Well, we have to really reexamine who our allies are and who our enemies are. I would put those groups on the enemy list, and Trump, during the campaign, he did make a bunch of hostile comments regarding, Saudi Arabia, a sponsor of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like he's been turned around on that. And also, the European Union, once again, I don't think we'll ever, hopefully never get in sort of a shooting war with them, but they've got their own agenda. And we certainly see it loud and clear in the whole climate thing. That they were quite willing to undermine the economies of a lot of other countries in the world to save themselves. So if we need something of a diplomatic revolution where we will sort of re-investigate who our friends are and who our enemies are, and then what the Americans have got, one of the big problems is, of course, just the military-industrial complex. I think that America probably spends, you know, vastly more than they need to on their own defense. If it was just a matter of really defending the country, they would not need anywhere near that kind of military outlays.
No, it's if okay they stay out of other countries, they don't.
Weaponry.
Yeah, I say if they stay out of all these other countries, they don't need that much.
Exactly.
But, yeah, but we have to go over and be the world police.
His estimate was 68 countries in the world right now can call upon the Americans for defense. I mean, they've entangled themselves with that many different countries. You know,
right.
if Montenegro gets invaded, you know, we could set up World War III. And John McCain was just, you know, apoplectic because he wasn't getting enough support in the Senate to get Montenegro into NATO. And there's all these countries now that can rely on the Americans for defense. Trump ran on a campaign of disentanglement, of non-intervention. You know, George Washington preached about that, like, don't get involved in old Europe's wars, all these, you know, dynastic struggles and what have you. But it seems to me that, you know, Eisenhower wasn't, you know, whistling Dixie when he warned about the military-industrial complex. It is a very powerful lobby. They like the fact that America is, you know, integrated into all these problem spots around the world. And that is something that really, that's the core part of the deep state. And that's something that a lot of people, myself included, thought that Trump was going to resist.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order at times.
We got to take a break, but let's talk about what happens if we do pull out of those areas. What kind of a vacuum do we create?
Were you reading my mind?
Yeah, I was. I was right there.
Still focusing on the devil thing.
Free rent right there for a minute.
Bill's taking out rent in my head. We'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Always the trick.
Yeah, find out who your friends are.
Who actually are your friends.
Yeah, we don't know.
It's a shifting target over there.
It is. They're your friends today, but then you're shooting at them tomorrow.
Yeah, but you don't know who they are. I mean, all these guys
I know it. That's the big problem. You don't know who's who. And so William, what happens? Okay, so we decide, you know what? We need to get our mitts out of everybody else's business and let them sell it themselves. I think, wouldn't that create like this huge void for obviously our enemies to move in and take over and basically start doing the same thing we're doing, which worked out really well for Russia and Afghanistan. They decided to, you know, that they got beat on pretty hard over there and they pulled out and left it to us. And now, you know, we're in the same shape. But what do you do? I mean, do you create the void?
Well, to some extent, I think America is making enemies where they need not, by getting involved in those countries. I look at the Arab world, and it seems to me that it's sort of locked in this long-term Republican versus monarchist struggle that America had during the revolution, that, you know, the English had during the English Civil War. It's happened in many places where you've got monarchies, and then there's an effort to overthrow them. Of course, the forces that are trying to overthrow the monarchies are not always really nice, progressive, you know, democratic type people. And you get some pretty harsh regimes trying to overthrow the monarchs. But that's what the Arab world is locked into. You go back to, say, 1950s. So there's some kids screaming in the hallway here.
I'm like, hey, are you running the daycare on the side?
All of those countries are monarchs. Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya. These are all absolute monarchies, much in the same manner that, Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi are now. There was a Republican uprising across the entire Arab world, and some countries became republics. But the sad fact was that many of the countries that became republics ended up with these sort of one-family tyrannies that looked a lot right. like monarchies. Like you had Assad, the Assad dynasty in Syria. You had Gaddafi in Libya. They weren't a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, they weren't democratic republics.
They were highly dictatorial.
Right.
But still, they were republics, and they tended to be a lot more democratic than Saudi Arabia. They tended to be a lot more secular and not quite as militantly Islamicist as the monarchies were. But across the Arab world, if you sort of just leave aside all the fake boundaries that the British and the French drew, there's this, long-term struggle between the Republican movement and the monarchist movement. And what the monarchists are trying to do is annihilate every Republican government. And they did it in Iraq, absolute disaster to the people. They did it in Libya, same thing. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do it in Syria. And, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, spinning in their graves that America would go to the Middle East and prop up these monarchs. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Kuwait was traditionally part of that country. To prop up the Emir of Kuwait again, and in all the after World War II, initially a lot of these monarchs were propped up by the British Empire. After World War II, the Americans stepped into the British boots. And they've been propping up these monarchs ever since.
No, you're absolutely right. We've got to take a break here at the top of the hour, but let's get right back on that and talk about what happens when we try to influence and put in a democratic republic in an area that's never had one.
And doesn't want it.
And doesn't
want it. At the end of the day, they don't know how to run it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we'll be back.
You have been listening to We the People. We will be back for another hour with our guest, William Kay, out of Alberta, Canada. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.